Action Cast.
Wiley, Texas, 1980. A gruesome murder shocks the small suburban town. A seemingly average, ordinary housewife is the primary suspect. What began as subtle flirting grew into deceit so intense, it ended in murder. Today, we dive into the true story, as well as the first television adaptation of Candy Montgomery. Welcome to another episode of The Cabinet of Dr. Mystery. I am your host, Dr. Mystery.
I tried to create living zombies.
Reports that have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things.
All I gotta do is relax and they'll take me to their death.
Last chance to evacuate Earth before it is recycled.
This is a wicked, wicked world.
We are all evil in some form or another.
Welcome, Mysterians, to another episode of The Cabinet of Dr. Mystery. I'm also really excited to welcome you to a brand new season. Welcome to the first episode of Season 3. Now, typically, we start our seasons in October. We like to start them with Halloween. It's just something that is kind of, I don't know, ritualistic. You know, when we first started the series, it began in October, and I started talking about Hallow's Eve and all the different aspects about Halloween. So I really wanted to, you know, start every season in October. However, you know, we took a little bit of a break in the last season. So I wanted to wrap up the Richard Kuklinski Iceman series before we started season 3. I figured why not finish and wrap up everything that we were talking about in the previous season, and why don't we start fresh with something new and exciting. Now, I do want to say that this episode, not only does it deal with a little bit of gore and a lot of violence, it also deals with a lot of marital infidelity. So if those two things, or if one of those things, are something that you're not really interested in hearing about, then maybe skip this episode. We do have some really cool ones coming out in the future. But this episode is something that was really, really interesting to me. You'll see as we go through this why it interests me. I really like looking at cases that are unconventional, cases where people use different, defense pleas and different arguments within the court system. And I really enjoy looking at specific incidents where they don't go with the norm. And this episode, this content doesn't go with the norm. If you think about self-defense and the logistics behind having a self-defense plea, this case was actually like baffling to people about how the jury came to the conclusion that they did. Before we begin this episode, I just want to apologize for the length of time between episodes and how we've been a little bit sporadic in the last year or so. There's a lot that's been going on in my personal life, and there's a lot with COVID, and there's a lot with everything. And, you know, life is a lot sometimes, and there are some people that help me out behind the scenes. But, you know, it is mainly myself doing this. I don't really have a whole lot of people that work on scripts with me, and I'm mainly the one recording and editing. So, you know, sometimes life gets in the way. I have other projects that I'm working on. There's a lot that goes on in everybody's personal life. So every once in a while, you have to try to figure out how to juggle everything and how to balance your time. And unfortunately, I'm not very good at that, as we can see. But, you know, I want to just thank everybody so much. Everybody that listens to any of these episodes, every single play that I get, anytime I get a comment on a post or, a direct message or somebody just telling me how much they care about the show and how much they enjoy it, you know, I appreciate you so much. This show would not be possible without you and your support. And, you know, I thank you so much over the last few years for your continued support, even though we've had to take some breaks in between. Thank you so much for listening to the Cabinet of Dr. Mystery and Dr. Mystery himself rant. You know, recording these shows is very therapeutic for me as well. So I appreciate you listening to me rant and make jokes. And, you know, this is a really good outlet for me. And this is a perfect way for me to balance everything going on in my life and just relax and talk to you guys and relate to you about gruesome murders, alien abductions, and all that crazy stuff. So without further ado, let's jump into Candy Montgomery and the crazy story that is this incident. Wiley, Texas, a suburb northeast of Dallas, with a population of 3,000 in 1980. Two housewives, Candy Montgomery and Betty Gore first met at the Methodist Church of Lucas. Candy's life revolved around the church, and she took an active role in the church activities and functions. Candy was a pillar of the community. Active in almost every town function, she and her family were seen as the perfect ideal American family. Together, the Gores and the Montgomerys sang in the choir and organized multiple church and community events. Being so involved within the church and the community, the Gores and the Montgomerys' children soon became close friends, frequently spending lots of time together, including sleepovers and playdates. After 9 months of befriending Betty and her husband, Alan Gore, Candy began fantasizing about taking Alan to bed. What started as an innocent incident on the volleyball court, where the two collided, it developed into much more. Candy was bored with her simple American lifestyle, and she longed for something exciting. Something, as she had put it, to, quote-unquote, spice up her life. One day after volleyball practice at the church, Candy approached Alan, telling him how attracted she was to him and asking if he'd like to start an affair. On December 12th, 1978, at the Continental Inn, located near where Alan worked, the two began an affair that would end bloody and violently. In February of the following year, Candy began to develop an emotional connection to Alan. Their agreement had been that if either of them had become emotionally attached, they would end the affair immediately. While Candy attempted to end the affair, Alan convinced her they should continue. In early June, Alan asked Candy if they could take a break from their affair, which sounds incredibly weird to me, but he wanted to focus more on his family, as Betty was pregnant with their second child. Candy agreed, and she even threw a surprise baby shower for her friend. In early July, after the birth of their second child, Betty and Alan Gore became closer than ever. Later that month, Alan and Candy resumed their extramarital affair, but Alan couldn't shake the feeling of pure, unadulterated guilt. At this point, Alan asked to end the affair. Alan and Betty began attending marriage counseling, which was organized by the church. While attending marriage counseling, Alan began to find a renewed sense of love and admiration for his wife and the mother of his children. Realizing the mistake that he had made and reeling from the guilt of what he had done, Alan and Candy agreed that they would no longer see each other. On June 13, 1980, Alan went away on a business trip to Minnesota. That morning, Betty had seemed distraught that Alan was leaving her for several days. She had never liked it when Alan left her home alone by herself for long periods of time. Shortly before boarding the plane, Alan attempted to phone his wife at home to let her know that he was boarding. Once he arrived at his hotel, he began calling his wife repeatedly, as he was unable to reach her before boarding the plane, now once again unable to reach her at the hotel several hours later. As she wasn't picking up the landline at their home, he began to worry, and the longer that his calls went unanswered, the more Alan feared for his wife's safety. At this point, Alan called his neighbor to ask if he could go investigate and check in on his wife. He also called Candy, who was babysitting their eldest daughter while their daughters had a sleepover. Alan eventually called a second neighbor, who in turn called a third neighbor. Together, the three men went over to the Gore's residence. Initially, the men found that the front door was unlocked and slightly ajar. Fearing for Betty's safety, they all entered. I believe one of them had a pistol. After finding blood on the bathroom floor in the residence, one of the men began hearing their infant daughter crying in the crib. It was clear to the three men that the baby had been sitting in the crib all night, as its diaper was soaking wet and soaking into the crib and the bed itself. After discovering Betty's bloody corpse laying in the utility room, one of the three men had assumed that she had been shot, and he informed Alan over the phone that Betty was dead. An abundance of evidence was left at the crime scene, including bloody fingerprints, bloody footprints, and the murder weapon itself. Officials and community members began speculating that since there was an article open on the Gore's table about the new Stanley Kubrick movie, The Shining, which featured the main villain wielding an axe and attacking his wife and children, as well as the recent release of the Friday the 13th movies, all of this combined, members in the community began speculating that the boogeyman had come to life. Now, I should clarify that when we're talking about the boogeyman coming to life, it was more of this manifestation that everybody was afraid that there was a psycho killer that wasn't in the community that had traveled from outside of the community just to murder people. So it's reminiscent of Dennis the Menace and the Christopher Lloyd character where he's, just an outsider in the community. Until Alan had arrived at home and met with investigators after they had been able to look at the crime scene themselves, he had believed that Betty had taken her own life by gunshot, as that's what one of the men told him. When investigators informed him that she had been murdered with an axe, he was even more perplexed. Now, I should also add in here that everybody in the community was surprised and shocked that Alan wasn't more distraught by the death of his wife. Alan seemed to be fairly composed, and it seemed to everyone in the community that he was not that concerned or that sad or that distraught over the death of his wife. One of the young girls in the community had informed police that she had gone over to the Gore's residence to see if their eldest daughter was able to go outside and play. She then reported to police that she witnessed Candy leaving the Gore's residence around the same time that the murder would have taken place. Since Candy was the last known person to see or be around Betty, police began investigating her. However, as we'll go into in more detail in a moment here, Candy had a very, very solid alibi for that day. Now, going back to Alan, because of his demeanor, and obviously because he's the closest person to his wife, he was questioned about his whereabouts and he had to confirm his alibi. Now, obviously, he flew out of the state and he was in a different part of the country. He was able to confirm his whereabouts via travel documents and hotel records. He did, however, inform police that he had an affair with a fellow church member, Candy Montgomery, that had ended 7 months prior to Betty's murder. Police then ran Candy's fingerprints against the bloody fingerprints found at the scene of the crime and discovered they were an exact match. And on June 27, 1980, Candy was arrested and charged with the murder of Betty Montgomery. Candy Montgomery's trial began in October of 1980, and Candy's defense attorney presented her plea as self-defense. Before the trial began, the defense attorney had her hypnotized. During these hypnosis sessions, they had discovered repressed trauma from her childhood in regards to her mother's actions. While recalling the bloody massacre on the witness stand, this was Candy's version of events. She was at a church function with her daughter and Betty's daughter as well, with Bible study starting shortly after the church function. While the girls were in Bible study, Candy went over to Betty's place to grab the young girl's swimsuit because the girls had a swim lesson later. Now, while Candy was at the Gore's residence, Betty confronted her about the affair. According to Candy, she confessed that they had an affair, but that it had ended several months ago. Betty then retrieved an axe, shoving Candy into the utility room and confronting her with the weapon. While the two women were fighting and wrestling over the murder weapon, Betty shushed Candy, which caused her to have a dissociative reaction. Allegedly, the shushing had triggered an emotional response within Candy because of the trauma that she had experienced during her childhood from her mother. A psychiatrist took the stand and explained to the jury that Candy had been struck with a sharp instrument when she was a child. As she cried out after being struck, her mother shook her and then shushed her. Candy and her psychiatrist claimed that Betty made the same gesture and sound as her mother had done during their altercation. This set her into an adrenaline-filled rage. And on Friday, June 13th, 1980, Candy Montgomery murdered Betty Gore with 41 blows to the head, neck, and body. Now, 28 of those blows were to the head alone. After exhausting herself, realizing what she had done, Betty attempted to clean up the crime scene and herself. Candy then took a shower, changed her clothes, and resumed her normal American lifestyle. Candy picked up the girls from Bible study. She took them out to their swimming lessons. She even went to The Empire Strikes Back in theaters, made the kids suffer, and put them to bed. Now, the real reason that I wanted to cover this was this doesn't sound like a regular self-defense plea. A regular self-defense plea is somebody attacked you and you prevented them from murdering you or hurting you in some way. Murdering somebody with 41 blows from an axe is not a typical self-defense plea. Murdering somebody and striking them with a weapon 41 times until you exhaust yourself is not a regular self-defense plea. Now, although this isn't a regular self-defense plea, the jury eventually found Candy not guilty. This shocked the entire community, and there was a media frenzy over this, and it was speculation for years and years, and there have been plenty of movies, plenty of books, and now television adaptations about the incident. But if we look at Candy, just to wrap up Candy and her life and the incident itself before we start talking about the new Hulu series, Candy, she had moved out of the small town with her family and moved to Georgia after changing her last name. Now, as you could have guessed, her relationship with her husband did not work out after this, and they divorced soon after. From all the research that I've found, Alan Gore moved away, and he actually had his children. They were taken away by his family. I'm not sure if it was his parents or if it was Betty's parents, but he no longer had custody of his children. And after he moved, he got remarried. That marriage didn't work out. And from all of my research, he now has a girlfriend in a small town, and he has tried to reconnect with his children. I imagine that this entire situation would fuck you up for life. Now, oddly enough, after Candy had moved, she began a career with her daughter, Jenny, as a mental health therapist, counseling individuals who suffer from depression. Now let's dive into the series, Candy, on Hulu, out now. When the series first opens up, we are introduced to this lifestyle, this way of life back in the 80s when this occurred. They really captured, from my perspective, from someone reading back on history, they captured what it would be like to live in this time era, to be a part of this close-knit society, this close-knit community. And one thing that was really interesting to me was the sets from the series, the costume designs, the interior design, the vehicles, the homes, and really how everyone interacted and how well they portrayed people interacting. It was spot on, in my opinion, from what I've heard of or what I've read or what I've experienced from different documentaries or television series or things that I've seen about that time period. Now, I'm talking about it as if it's like the 1800s, but this is the 80s here. One thing that I would say about this entire series was that, when I first started it, it was a little bit slow. I was expecting more depictions of violence. I was expecting more of a sped up production and more, just more. At the very beginning, it didn't seem very meaty. You know, it wasn't a solid, heavy thing that I was watching. And, you know, I pushed through because I'm really interested in this case itself. And I recommend that if you experience that same thing where you're like, this isn't really that interesting, or like, this isn't really moving that quickly, I encourage you to tough it out because it is well worth it. I would say that this series was more of a slow burn than anything else, and I think the slow burn was worth it in the end. So this case was really interesting to me, but I figured I would just check out the series and see what it was all about. I didn't really plan on doing a full episode about it. I didn't really even plan on talking about it on the show at all. But after I watched the series, I was like, all right, I need to learn a little bit more about this because I knew about it and it was interesting to me, but I didn't actually invest any time to study it at all. The series was amazing. And after I watched it, like I said, it was amazing. It was a phenomenal series and I encourage you to check it out. But I just kind of left, it just kind of, I felt unfulfilled, like it left me wanting more. I needed more information. I needed more detail. The way that it was structured was really well, and the series itself was amazing. And the lead actors and even the you know, minor actors and characters in this, they did an amazing job, and it was a phenomenal series. But I just needed more, you know? Throughout the series, I thought Jessica Biel's portrayal of Candy was spot on from what I've seen in pictures and videos and all the documentaries that I've watched and everything that I've heard. I thought it was really phenomenal. You know, and it was kind of similar to the same thing with the Gypsy Rose series that we covered, you know, a little while back. It was amazing to see how a makeup artist can take a really beautiful, vibrant person that has typical features and prominent features that we've seen in many films and TV shows that we recognize from Jessica Biel and from, you know, the actors that were in Gypsy Rose, and turn them into, you know, an incredibly realistic version of, you know, these generic human beings that look nothing like the actress or the actor in question. And I thought that was really phenomenal. And that was a huge selling point was, you know, when I first saw photographs or the you know, advertisements for this series, I thought it was amazing watching Jessica Biel portrayed in that way. Episode 5 is the real climactic scene from the series. You know, it's the final showdown, the final moments of this life before Candy and Betty have this altercation. In the series, we see that the two women, you know, they're arguing over Alan and they're wrestling over the axe as well. So they're just fighting over Alan. And, you know, to be honest with you, Pablo Schreiber, he's looking pretty fresh for somebody from this time, you know. He's looking pretty good, but I don't know if the real Alan Gore was worth fighting over, but I would fight over Pablo Schreiber. I don't think I would kill anybody for Pablo, but, you know, I'd definitely get in an argument for sure. In the series, we see that the lawyers are taking this as a self-defense case, which is what we discussed earlier. I don't want to give too much away, but you've already listened to this entire episode, so at this point, I feel like you can just guess what's happening. But in the series, you can really see that the lawyers are going for this self-defense angle. And in episode 5, we really see the whole trial aspect, and we see Candy recounting her perspective of events. Like I said in the beginning of this whole section about discussing the TV series, it was a slow burn. Each episode is 45 minutes to an hour long. The 4 hours or so that it took for us to get to this point, it was like each episode is valuable. When you get to the episode 5 and you had that climactic, you know, the final showdown, so to speak. I don't know if that's the right way to talk about it, but, you know, you're watching it and it's the slow burn, but everything is valuable. Everything is necessary. So it's definitely worth it to pay attention and focus on those first four episodes, because it, you know, they really build a suspense and they give you a good understanding of these two families in this small community. And I think overall the series was really well done. The only thing that really hurts me was just how long it took for us to get to this point, that we really didn't discuss anything that happened until episode 5. You see little glimpses of violence, you get little tidbits of information the whole way through. And I mean, I guess that's how it plays out if you're actually living this case out in real life. If you're, you know, related to the victims, or you're related to the perpetrator, or you're just watching this in real time from the perspective of this being X amount of years later, it was difficult to watch the entire series and not be like, you know, let's get to the actual meat of the subject. And like I said, in episode 5, we really, really get to see the viciousness and the violence that happens, and we really get down to the heart of this subject in this case. In one of these final scenes of the series, we really see the brutality and the viciousness and the violence and the bloodiness that Candy threw at, through sheer rage, blinding aggression. It just gave her this out-of-body experience. That's what Candy and the psychiatrist claim, you know, this pure aggression that just took her completely away from reality. And we see that in the series. Jessica Biel as Candy Montgomery, she describes it as taking a step back, not even being present, and just mentally just watching this happen as she brutally murders her friend. And in the series, I think like the way they portrayed it, we really, really see that. Now, Melanie Linsky, she looks completely unrecognizable as a bloody, disfigured, absolutely brutalized Betty Gore. She looks nothing like herself. And it was absolutely phenomenal to see the progression of the violence and to see what the makeup crew did. It looks incredibly realistic, and it's absolutely frightening to see Jessica Biel display that rage and to see Melanie Lynskey look like that afterwards. It's crazy. It's fucking crazy. One thing I will say, I have never watched a court hearing, seen a documentary, or seen a retelling, a fictional show or a film, with a judge in it that I hate as much as the judge in this one. The judge in this series is an absolute dickhead, and it sucks because I don't know who the actor is, but I don't like him already because of his portrayal of this judge. This poor actor had to play the biggest dickhead in the entirety of cinema history, and I feel bad for him, but I absolutely fucking hate him. So I hope you all enjoyed this breakdown of the new Candy series on Hulu. And I hope that you enjoyed a little bit more background on Candy Montgomery and the murder of Betty Gore as well. I know that most of our episodes have been a little shorter lately. Typically, we have like 45 minutes to an hour. Sometimes we go over that. The episodes that we've been releasing lately have been 30 to 45 minutes. So, you know, I understand that you guys might be looking for something a little more meaty. So in the future, we'll try to pick a few topics that could have multi-part series, or that could be, you know, they have a little bit more meat and a little bit more to break down in them. But I hope that you enjoy the new content that we're releasing out as well. As always, let us know what you think about the episode. Let us know what you think about Candy Montgomery and this murder of Betty Gore. Reach out to us on Discord, reach out to us on Twitter or via email or wherever you see us. We always love hearing from you. Stay safe out there, and you know, we're getting close to Christmas, so I hope everybody has a wonderful holiday, and I hope that you're down to check out our Christmas episode. I'm gonna just talk instead of writing up a whole script, and you know, I'm probably just gonna wing it and just relax and have some eggnog and maybe take a couple dab hits and just chill out a little bit. So I hope you're interested in joining us for our upcoming Christmas episode. And, you know, like I said before, stay safe out there. And thank you so much for your continued support. I appreciate every single one of you that's listening to this episode. This episode is produced by Death Hotel Creative. Hosted by myself, Dr. Mystery. To view more and to grab your exclusive Cabinet of Mystery merch, visit us at notwhatwesay.com. Check out our Instagram handle at Cabinet of Mystery or our Twitter at Open the Cabinet. Please leave us a review if you enjoyed the show, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear in the future. You can let us know either on the socials or at cabinetofmystery@gmail.com. If you'd like to leave us a voice message and appear in upcoming episodes, leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/cabinetofmystery. For sources on this episode, please see the episode description. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe or follow for more episodes.